Thank you for joining the Unit Finance Initiative webinar in conjunction with the launch of Ready, Set, Grow, Part 2 Recommendations for International Climate Change Negotiators. Sebastian Mello, Head of Communications at UNEP-FI, is here to welcome you. Please go ahead.
Hello, everyone. My name is Sebastian Mello. As I was just told, I am Head of Communications at UNEP Finance Initiative. We're very pleased that you've responded so numerously to this invitation to attend this webinar on the occasion of the launch of a new UNEP-FI report. There are currently 65 people attending this webinar, so I'd like to extend my warmest welcome to all of you. So earlier this year in May, UNEP-FI launched the first of a two-part report titled Ready, Set, Grow, Roles and Opportunities for the Private Sector in Forest Carbon Markets. And with that report, we established that the private sector could play an important role in global efforts to reduce deforestation and forest degradation deployed in the framework of the recently adopted REDD+ scheme. With part two of Ready, Set, Grow, which we're launching today, we now explore what features the private sector thinks are desirable in forest-related climate change regime that is effective in mobilizing involvement and funding from private finance. The webinar will last about an hour. It will begin with a context-setting presentation of the report by Andrew Mitchell, who is founder and director of the Global Canopy Program. This will be followed by a presentation of the report's finding and conclusions by Abid Karmali, who's Managing Director and Global Head of Carbon Markets at Bank of America Merrill Lynch, and Christian Del Valle, Director of Environmental Markets at BNP Paribas. And both Bank of America Merrill Lynch and BNP Paribas are UNEP-FI members. Following this, we'll hear some remarks and reactions to the recommendations formulated in the report by a representative of the UK government, as well as by Ravi Prabhu, who is Senior Program Officer at UNEP and the UN REDD focal point at UNEP. The government representative will be Stephen Cornelius, Head of Forests and Land Use Negotiations at the Department of Energy and Climate Change of the United Kingdom. Andrew Mitchell will act as the moderator during that discussion. Please note that throughout the webinar, you'll be muted. You can, however, voice your questions, and you're encouraged to do so at any time by using the chat function, which you can currently see on your screen. Your questions will be noted and will by the moderator, who will pose them to the speakers when appropriate. So without waiting anymore, I give the floor to Andrew Mitchell to present to you a context-setting presentation of Ready, Set, Grow Part 2, Recommendations for International Climate Change Negotiators. Andrew.
Good morning, everybody. I'm going to give you a very short presentation of the context, as I see it, for forests and climate change into which this report goes. And for that, as a short presentation, and then we'll go on to the other speakers. So if we could go to the next slide. I just think that forests are, and also I should say at the outset, I'm not sure of the level of knowledge of the people who are listening to me. So you'll just have to forgive me if this is obvious to you, but it may be new to some others. Forests, I believe, are an interesting proxy for the green economy to come. It helps us to change our thinking, in particular, about the importance of natural capital in the business cycle. And one thing we need to understand is that all wealth creation, or a great deal of wealth creation, depends on natural capital. Forests are a very good example of that natural capital. And the problem that we have with tropical forests is that they're not valued standing up, they're valued when they're cut down and turned into something else. So in order to save forests, we've got to think about them differently. We have to value them differently. And perhaps we should start to see these large forests going all the way around the equator as providing an ecosystem service. They're like ecological infrastructure. I even call them eco-utilities, like power stations, providing services that we all use, but we don't yet pay for. Now, policy and funding mechanisms are being reset to recognize this service. And this is a major and important step towards the green economy. The ecosystem services that forests provide are very large indeed. We'll hear Abid talk about that in a minute. But they are not just carbon, it's also to do with water, the protection of biodiversity and livelihoods. And these services could make forests worth more alive than dead. That's basically the theme of what I'm just going to talk about. So if we go to the next slide, what you see on the left is the large-scale burning of tropical forests that has gone on for a number of decades. And this has resulted in huge amounts of forests disappearing from the tropics. Now, this became very important recently because of the carbon emissions coming from these forests going into the atmosphere. And this is all about this crisis of values. In the bottom right, you see lots of forests. That doesn't really have a value. Governments can't get huge amounts of money just for leaving that forest there. When you burn the forest and change it into something else, as happens, for instance, on a large scale in Latin America, it's converted to agriculture, and you can get money for that. So the price signals are completely in conflict with each other, in a sense. Now, these are called externalities in the economy. Business does not include the cost of the carbon going up in the atmosphere in the price of products that are sold all over the world. And that's called an externality, an economic externality. So what's happened is that science has put out an alarm bell saying that these emissions are large and are going to drive climate change. That needs a policy change, and it has a financial impact. And that's all come together as RED, reducing emissions from deforestation and degradation, which is the policy response to this problem. Next slide. So a new vision for these forests is emerging, where forest-owning nations have immense natural capital, the first product, in a sense, of which is carbon. And it's carbon standing in the trees, it's carbon dioxide sucked out of the atmosphere by these trees. And, of course, this, in the RED scenario, could become extremely valuable for these nations. So they become providers of global ecosystem services, which may have a value in the future. Next slide. The first driver of this change really is climate. There'll be no solution to climate change without a solution to deforestation. That sort of sentiment has been put out in the international community for quite a few years now, but it was relatively new before the Bali conference of the UNFCCC, when forests got included in the Bali roadmap. The important thing to recognize, we hear a lot about aircraft emissions, but it's only about 2% of global emissions, whereas those from forests are around about 18%. So it's absolutely huge. It's almost as much as the entire global transport sector. And we need to deal with that quickly, and we can. Next slide. You can see from this slide here, if you look at the top, this shows the opportunity for getting CO2 out of the atmosphere over the next few decades. And if you see the top power and then go down to the bottom and you'll see forestry and agriculture, you can see the two biggest opportunities for taking carbon out of the atmosphere between now and 2030 is power sector and forestry. So forestry is an extremely important sector when taking carbon out of the atmosphere. Next slide. The other important thing to recognize, it's not just about carbon. Forests are eco-utilities providing much more than this carbon cycle service. And we are seeing a growing interest now in the relationship between forests and water and agriculture. They are huge water suppliers, and the next slide will show how that works. If you imagine the Amazon right across Amazonia there, the moist trade winds come in across from the Atlantic and are recycled right across towards the Andes and then with jet streams probably down to the La Plata Basin. That water cycle feeds huge amounts of agriculture in that region. If you remove the forests, there is a high probability all the models, about 50% of the models, are showing a potential 50% reduction in water over time across Amazonia if deforestation continues coupled with climate change. These are very big risks for business. Next slide. Another important driver of this change is demand, and by that I mean consumer demand. Increasing awareness that the products we all use help to cause deforestation. And this means beef that is coming out of principally Brazil, soy also, palm oil from Southeast Asia, and so on. These products are traded worldwide. Forests are converted to grow them. And they are used in products that we all eat, use as cosmetics, put on our hair in the shower. They're absolutely worldwide. And so this is one of the major causes of deforestation. And red won't work unless we deal with what drives deforestation. And this expansion of agriculture is very important for that. So that's another key demand. Next one, please. So what has happened in the policy scenario? We've seen an evolution over the last decade or so since the Kyoto Protocol, where the CDM, the Clean Development Mechanism, was born, which allows you to get a carbon credit for planting new trees, but not for protecting old ones. Since the Bali Conference, we had RED, reducing emissions from deforestation and degradation, and that has now become RED Plus to recognize the additional services such as the water cycle, biodiversity, and so on. And that's the circle up in the top left. But there is also a beginning move to go beyond RED to consider these other ecosystem services that I've mentioned, such as water, in proactive investment and natural capital. That's not something in the negotiations at present, but PINC means proactive investment in natural capital, and that includes a new framework for looking at forests which goes beyond the carbon cycle. The price, well, with carbon it's easy, a ton of CO2, and the question is, what's the price for that where forests are concerned? And that's the big question. Next slide. The billion-dollar question here is, who would pay for these forest carbon credits? And how much is needed? It's about 17 to 33 billion to halve deforestation by 2020 and going on to 2030. The carbon is the first service to be valued. There are lots of potential sources for this. It's not just the private sector. There's also international auctioning of AAUs and other kinds of sources. But most of that comes down to two things, either government money, taxes, or the private sector. And the interesting thing is that there's about $4.2 billion that's now being put in place by governments to make all this happen. So things are moving. Next slide. And so we're seeing the emergence of, if you like, a green economy, where these forests and the services that they provide that underpin food security, energy security, climate security, health security, and livelihoods are going to be valued in the future, and carbon is the first one. So this report is a very important step on the way for advising negotiators on how that might happen. So I'm now going to turn it over to Abid to take you through some of the findings of the report. Abid Kamali, Managing Director, Global Head of Carbon for Bank of America Merrill Lynch. Abid, over to you.
Thanks very much, Andrew, for setting the context so well. If we could have the next slide, please. And first of all, I think we must say that we're very grateful to UNEP for convening this initiative. Some of you may recall that, in fact, this is the second part of a two-part series. Part one was a briefing for financial institutions on essentially how to become involved in this activity. What are the commercial avenues for participating in this? What are the barriers and what are the risks? And part two, which is very timely, given we're only now 3 months away from the next major milestone in the UN climate change negotiations taking place in Durban, is really aimed at policymakers, the negotiators. What are the variety of options to best catalyze private investment and engagement into forestry mitigation? Next slide, please. So, I think the first and most critical question is to ask, well, why on earth is private capital required? And to those of us who've been involved in this study, there's a pretty compelling set of reasons. You've heard from Andrew that we need to see something on the order of a 50% reduction in deforestation by 2020 to meet the scientific target. And we've also heard that in the business as usual scenario, the costs of damages to the global economy would be on the order of about $1 trillion a year. The value of ecosystem services, if measured correctly, would come out at around $5 trillion per year. So there's a pretty compelling case for finding a way to put value into forests and ecosystem services. And by doing this, we would see a stopping of tropical deforestation, forest degradation, and planting new forests that could provide equivalent benefits to other measures such as constructing 2 million wind turbines or doubling nuclear energy capacity. So there's some interesting metrics of comparison to see what similar measures could be required to do the same thing. And many people come to the same conclusion, which is capital deployed in the forestry sector is actually an easier alternative, given the the costs involved, and also given the immediacy of results. If we can go to the next slide, please. As Andrew stated, essentially there are two parts of the financial equation. It's capital that has to come from the private sector, or capital that has to come from the public sector, from public budgets. And at present, given the austerity efforts in most, if not all, developed countries, it's difficult to anticipate how those funds could be delivered through the public sector alone. That is not to downplay the importance of some of those commitments that were mentioned. We are seeing roughly $7 billion per year flowing into this space, and that's underpinned by countries such as Norway and others, of course, who've made those important pledges. But I think the key conclusion, the key takeaway, is that at present it's difficult to say that public finance alone is going to be sufficient to finance the large-scale implementation of REDD+ and other activities required on the ground. And so therefore, we have to think about how to mobilize investment and finance from private sources. Without it, there will be no success of the REDD+ scheme. And you can see that illustrated in this graph. What we have here is the dark blue shades in the bar charts are equivalent to the minimum estimate of investment needs, and the light blue indicate the higher estimates. And what you see in purple on the far right is the current public funding available. So the key takeaway here is that public funding available is absolutely dwarfed by the scale of investment that's required. And that's why we have to find ways to engage with private capital. Next slide, please. And earlier I mentioned that we need to address the underlying drivers of deforestation, that is critical to shifting behavior in the private sector. This essentially means changing behavior in ways such as offering financially competitive alternatives to current land use and deforestation patterns. So only if investing in forest protection, conservation, and enhancement if those activities can offer revenue streams competitive with those from the existing production of timber and agricultural commodities like soybeans, palm oil, and beef, can we see a genuine shift in private sector behavior? And it's only through that that we'll unlock the skills and resources required to achieve the deforestation targets that need to be set. And this graph shows what's driving deforestation in the Brazilian Amazon. Basically, you look at that and you realize that it's global demand for soya and red meat. Over 80% of Brazilian soya is used for feedstock for cattle. And so therefore, it's essentially it's meat demand that is really driving deforestation in Brazil. And that demand is, of course, coming from areas such as Europe and North America. If we go to the next slide, please. So I think the next question to ask is, well, how can private finance and investment become involved in this space? There has been some involvement of the private sector to date, primarily on the margins in terms of helping to provide options into the UNFCCC process. But where we are now, that is to say, as of the Cancun negotiations in December last year, the decision was taken to leave the REDD+ financing decision open as an open question. So right now there is no answer that's been negotiated by the parties as to how the finance part of REDD+ will come to play. And I think, you know, what we are picking up is that there are all kinds of financial options, including market-based options, that have support from both the Annex I countries and the developing countries. And our expectation is that in the coming months, starting, for example, in Panama next month, there will be some there'll be some more focus on what specific financial options would be viable, and perhaps even what kinds of governing principles could guide the decision on financing options. One of the main contributions of this of this book is that there are a whole variety of scenarios for finance which are examined in great detail and analyzed and evaluated on a whole series of metrics. And basically, one of the most important findings, at the high level anyway, is that not all of the scenarios identified will stimulate private sector involvement in REDD+ efforts. And so I think you know, Christian is going to go in greater detail into the specifics of the scenario comparison, but that is one of the most important contributions from this work. There is a fundamental difference in the design of mechanisms which can stimulate private sector capital involvement, and we need to make sure that the outcome in Durban reflects that evaluation as best as possible. So I think I will now pass it on to Christian on the next slide.
Thank you very much, Abid. I'd now like to introduce Christian De Valle, who's Director of Environmental Markets at BNP Paribas. Christian, over to you.
Thank you very much, Andrew, and thank you, Abid. And thanks to UNEP for organizing and publishing what I think we all feel is a very useful report, particularly, as Abid said, given the context of the timing which we find ourselves. I think a coherent, strong, and clear message to policymakers and to negotiators is very important at this point in time. Because as we said for two COPs now in a row, REDD is a point of light. I think as has been alluded to previously, and is brought out in the report, REDD is very much, I suppose, subject, or I don't want to say held hostage, but to some extent it is. Its progress is subject to progress on an overall basis. And just touching upon the slide right before that Abid was talking about, when we start to talk about how REDD will be financed, right now you've had that as a lingering, if you will, item that's been kicked into touch for two COPs in a row, particularly in Cancun. There are ideological views on one side that are quite strongly rooted, that have aversion to the concept of private sector being involved for fears of commoditization of forests, etc. And then there are also strategic reasons why an ultimate decision on how REDD is financed is very difficult, very problematical for countries to take in advance of knowing how overall climate mitigation and adaptation are going to be financed and to what targets globally we're going to be attempting to achieve. So the lack of progress on finance is to be understood, but the imperatives that have been pointed out by Andrew and Abid still exist, and I think the challenge to us all is to find a way that we set the table for private sector involvement, both in a negative and positive way. And when I say a negative, you can go to the next slide now, Andrew. When I say a negative way, I mean actually deploying private capital in such a way that existing drivers of deforestation associated with current private sector activities are arrested altogether or certainly slowed, and in a positive way to actually direct new money into forest protection, forest conservation, and sustainable use of forests. So will there be a deal? I think most of us are realists, and we're also well, it's not even once bitten, twice shy. It's thrice or four times bitten and many times shy. We have to go into to Durban with realistic expectations. I think that there has been a lot of momentum at the policymaker level, sovereign level, to really be able to come out of Durban with some of the arguments associated with finance on RED settled. But still, we do find ourselves, as I say, subject to the vagaries of the overall climate change deal. And that's important because we've got to remember why the private sector would be involved in RED or would be involved in reducing its negative impact on forests. And I believe that there are sort of three main reasons which these threads emerge through the report. Firstly, the private sector is you know, duty bound to operate within the international and local legal and jurisdictional framework in which it operates. So if there are policy measures or laws in place that commit it to certain stewardship aspects of how it impacts the forest, certain environmental considerations which must be made as part of business as usual, that can be imposed at a policy level, either locally or internationally. More difficult the latter. Also, companies want to maintain their license to operate. They don't want to create an image for themselves in a given part of the world whereby they become persona non grata. So there is a strong impetus to be seen as a good corporate citizen, and that sort of segues into the third sort of category, and that is maintaining or attracting existing clients. And we've seen this recently in the past year with resource-based companies, particularly operating in the oil palm sector in Indonesia, pulling away from sources that are deemed by NGOs and other stakeholders to be bad actors in the space, and they've these multinational companies have addressed their sourcing quite quickly, I might add. But really, what we're trying to do is get at scale and answer the question of who is going to actually be making the necessary payments. Who's going to be putting money into RED, not to just demonstrate local successes as we've done in the voluntary market and as corporate social responsibility activities have demonstrated as possible, but to really go at this at scale. And then, of course, you know, so who's going to foot the bill and who's going to be the recipient. So next slide, please, Andrew. Okay, that's great. So I think what we've got to at least at the UNFCCC level, is this notion of a phased approach on RED+. The idea that different countries can move at different paces and move from a general sort of readiness and capacity building phase through to a payment by proxy phase on to actual performance-based crediting. But because we haven't sorted out finance, it's still unclear. That the questions I raised in the last slide are still unclear. Who pays and who gets paid? The report attempts to sort of create a typology and look at each one of these, each possible outcome critically, with a view to coming up with an opinion and a recommendation on which one's actually, in the end, in the fullness of time, going to generate the most interest from the private sector. The first category, a national crediting system under a UNFCCC agreement, becomes difficult for sources of private capital, because effectively what you have is a club of 193 or however many sovereigns are in the UNFCCC these days, actors who are changing money money will change hands between them. And it's difficult for the private sector to deploy capital at a point that is several iterations removed from the point at which they get a return on that capital. And the farther that, you know, that the input of capital gets from the actual output of results, of potential profit, potential for profit, the less visibility the private sector has on whether or not he's taking on a risk that is too great to justify to his stakeholders, to his shareholders, to his board, and frankly, if you're down at the investment officer level, to your boss. So it's certainly not impossible for the private sector to get involved. There could be deals struck with sovereigns through a tender process, and we've seen that in other climate change arenas, other environmental arenas, and frankly in oil and gas. But I think it does it makes the process more laborious, and it puts at risk really developing scale of deployment and results in the short time. A subnational or project level crediting system under the UNFCCC is very attractive, or I should say it's more attractive to providers of private capital precisely for the inverse of the reasons I just described. If you can reduce the distance between where you're investing and where you see return coming from, and you can minimize the number of layers between that, it becomes more straightforward for the private sector. Clearly, being able to sign off on an agreement whereby you're confident that deforestation is going to be arrested across a national scale, where you have very little control over critical points of what's going to determine success or failure is difficult. If you can drill it down to a subnational level, particularly if you're dealing with smaller provinces, or even better yet, project level, it gets the private sector a lot happier. My personal belief, and I think others in the private sector would share this, generally speaking, it doesn't matter if you say national, subnational, or project. At the end of the day, investments get deployed at the project level. You may have a series of investments, you may have a series of projects which sit alongside each other and nest into to a larger framework, be it subnational or national, but at the end of the day, the investor intervenes at the project level, and that's the case not just in forests or climate change, but the world over when we're talking about project finance. So we need to keep that in mind. Here. The downside, or the perceived downside from some on this, and why it only has sort of one plus there on the slide, is that the smaller the scale of the accounting framework that you're dealing with, the greater, theoretically, the potential for leakage is. And if you're operating in a very small area, be it a project or even a small province, then it becomes it could become more difficult to account for leakage with just the shifting of activities. And this is, of course, particularly true when you're talking about drivers of deforestation, such as the ones that Abid mentioned, soya and oil palm, that the price of which is driven by global demand, globally traded commodities, and if one area reduces its output of oil palm, there's no guarantee that its neighbor isn't going to take advantage and fill his customers' orders. But by the same token, and it's necessary to point out, even a national accounting scheme is not a silver bullet or a panacea for leakage. And unless we develop a red scheme that not only addresses deforestation, which has been demonstrated to occur in the past, for instance, along a historical baseline, but also bring in a scheme that incentivizes those nations which, either for their own choosing or just because nobody came to do business with them in the last 20 years, have effectively been good stewards of their forests. And there needs to be an avenue for participation for those with the standing stocks, not just those who have experienced deforestation in the past, because I think doing that is another firewall against leakage. The third category, and it's the one really that is most important from the standpoint of the report, because it's a strong recommendation, is for a nested approach, which is a hybrid solution between scenario one and two. And that simply is allowing private sector investment to happen in the way that it naturally does, historically. But allowing that investment in the performance and indeed the potential for yield or crediting to be dependent upon its ability to nest into a wider framework. There's been an awful lot of very good work done by several organizations, NGOs, consultants, governments alike, on the best nesting strategy. I think that the report certainly highlights the bullet points there, and hopefully makes sure that a nested approach is at the top table when we get to Durban, and in the forefront of the minds of those negotiating parties who do wish to see a private sector funded solution to RED. Just as a quick anecdote on the investments in RED Plus that we're considering, we're already anticipating the need to nest, and thus, therefore, we look very much, certainly to the extent possible, at the ability to going so far as to deploy capital to construct that accounting framework for a wider jurisdiction. And this is difficult, certainly, when you're dealing in a country with big, with provinces the size larger than most European countries. But it is more straightforward in dealing in countries with projects that sit within reasonably well-contained provinces or provinces which, in terms of land use, do not share the same circumstances with their neighbors, because that is another way to help the private sector now choose investments.
Christian, we're running out of time, so okay. If you could move on, please.
I'm sorry about that. Yeah. Okay. So if you'd like to go ahead and switch to the next slide, that would be fine. Okay. So I think I've basically covered most of why the most promising approach is scenario three and a nested approach. Again, it goes back to the ability through a nested approach to make the performance-based payments directly to implementers of activities. And what that means is directly to the actors on the ground who are or choose not to be involved in deforestation. So you're maximizing efficiency by going right down to the actor level. You're insulating yourself to the extent possible from governance issues, bureaucracy issues, which could indeed result in payments being made, deforestation being arrested, but the actors involved actually not being compensated fairly for it, and that brings in sustainability issues for the entire program going forward. I think the last bullet point here on the slide is very important. Who is paying? It's fine to take a carbon tax approach, and we've seen important countries going down that route and having some success with it, most recently Australia. But at the end of the day, the idea of making the emitter finance the emission reductions has a neatness to it, and I believe it has incentives on both sides. Not only on arresting deforestation, but on creating incentives for people who are involved in emissions in the north or in major developing countries to reduce those as much as they can, thus reducing the amount that they have to pay at the end of the day to comply beyond what they're able to reduce internally. Next slide, please. And just very quickly, since we're running out of time, those of us who are active in Red Plus today, particularly in the VCS and CCB world, are having to think about fungibility. We need to make sure that investments in avoided deforestation that are being made now, demonstrating strong MRV capabilities, have a pathway for nesting into a future compliance framework. It doesn't make any sense for incentives to be for the private sector to do nothing today and just be ready to jump into the game if and when the perfect global deal hatches. There's a lot of momentum right now, not just from financial institutions and project developers, but from other intermediary companies, consumer-facing corporates, who want to be able to get involved and learn how RED is going to work. And we need to encourage that momentum to start now. Clearly, safeguards comes to mention quite a lot when we talk about the private sector. But equally, I've spoken to as many people in host countries who are far more comfortable with the private sector being a strong steward of safeguards rather than some public sector actors, or at least equally competent. At the end of the day, the private sector is going to have to operate within the legal and policy framework that is put forward for it to operate under, and certainly shortcuts on safeguards by private sector investors does nothing but amplify risks that an investment could go awry. So I think there is a linkage between safeguards, private sector, and risk reduction. And then the last two bullet points go hand in hand, I believe. I mean, these are just risks that it doesn't matter if the sources are coming from an EU fund generated from auction revenues, if it's coming from pledges, or if it's coming from private sector investment. You're going to have land tenure questions. You're going to have governance corruption issues. equitable distribution of benefits issues, and this is something that we're going to get right to a degree by talking about it at the policy level, but we must continue to learn whilst doing, and I think that's one of the advantages that the voluntary market has presented us with today. So on that note, I'll hand over to Stephen, and I look forward to his response on behalf of the public sector.
Thank you very much, Christian. I would ask the other two speakers, which are Stephen, Cornelius, and Ravi, to try to keep their remarks as short as possible so we have some time for Q&A. There are a number of questions coming through now which we'd like to have time to answer. So Stephen, who's head of forests and land use negotiations for the Department of Energy and Climate Change at the UK government, please could you come forward your remarks now.
Thanks, Andrew, and thanks to UNFI for this report, which I think is a really useful and timely contribution to the debate on REDD+ financing. I mean, from the UK point of view, REDD is an important tool in our fight against climate change. And alongside that, I think, you know, there are other things apart from climate change that's important for. So we believe, you know, halting deforestation will help tackle biodiversity loss and help with poverty alleviation. I think the previous speakers have shown, you know, why REDD is important. You know, Andrew's had a slide showing that it was 18% of global emissions, and there was, you know, that this meant that there was, you know, it's a cost-effective mitigation option. Avid sort of highlighted that. So we believe that it's essential to achieve our goal of limiting the mean temperature rise to 2 degrees above pre-industrial levels. So in terms of financing, we think you know, financing can help address the drivers. I think Abbott had a slide on this. You know, the drivers of deforestation and provide businesses and local communities with alternatives to the current unsustainable forestry practices. And the previous speakers and the report also highlight, you know, the fact that there is a funding gap. So the private sector involvement is crucial. The public sector funding alone won't be sufficient. In terms of REDD in the climate negotiations, Christian sort of highlighted the bits about safeguards and the like. So I'll focus on you know, how this, I think this contributes. I think, I mean, in terms of the climate negotiations have recognised that there's a clear need to scale up REDD mitigation and the financing. And Cancun came up with the idea that we would slow, halt, and reverse deforestation. The REDD mechanism that was established in Cancun was left, you know, it was established, but it was left open, the design, and so, you know, and hence the ability to mobilize the private sector. I think in terms of the future, you know, so in Panama, Abbott explained that we will be meeting there soon. In the negotiations, we will be exploring the financing options for the full implementation of results-based action. That's from the text. And we need to report back to Durban. So I think this report is really timely for that. It's a useful contribution because we've started our discussions as countries, as parties, but we need expert input from outside to help inform our discussions. So and so I think this report, I think there's workshops that will be held under the REDD+ partnership. There's a workshop in Panama hosted by Switzerland and the Philippines that look at sort of governance and framework for REDD financing. So I think all of this shows, you know, a momentum. In terms of the UK, just quickly, we have a international climate fund of £2.9 billion over 4 years, and around 20% of this is likely to be forest-related. We have, you know, we had an independent report that suggested, well, we need to invest in multilateral, we need to invest in bilateral, but we also need to catalyze private investment. So what I think this is useful in, the work that UNFFI and other reports are doing is, you know, giving ideas, what are the policy options, how can we, the UK, how can other countries leverage the finance, you know, what are the best means of identifying the support to the private sector. So these are sort of, you know, probably questions rather than answers. So how can we do this, in Andrew's opening presentation, how can we do this to address the market failures that currently don't value standing forests? In summary, I think, you know, RED is an important tool in our fight against climate change. We need to encourage the private sector investment in reducing deforestation. And I think this is, the private sector is financial institutions, but not exclusively financial institutions, because I believe that there are other broader private sector that needs to also be involved. And we need to encourage better practice across companies that contribute to the drivers of deforestation. I mean, forests will continue to be cleared because they're undervalued and markets do not reward the forest owners for environmental services that the forests provide. That's, I think, from Andrew's introduction. And this must change for long-term success of RED. So I think this report from UNFFI does a good job in outlining the problems. I think the possible scenarios and solutions that it proposes are good ones. And I believe that it will form a key contribution to the international debate going to Durban. Thank you.
Stephen, thank you very much for those comments, and I'm sure we'll come back to some of these questions in the discussion. For the group who are listening, and as we're behind time, we're going to extend this session by 15 minutes, so if you can carry on a little bit longer, we'll go on for another 15 minutes beyond the hour for those who can stay. We'll have a little more time for some Q&A. I understand some of the speakers may have to leave, but we'll carry on for another 15 minutes. I would now like to ask Ravi Prabhu for his remarks. He's Senior Program Officer for Forests and Climate at the UN RED Program. Ravi.
Thank you, Andrew. I'm going to keep it fairly short because I do want to hear the questions that people have. From the work of the UN RED program and from UNEP's own work on RED in countries, I would like to draw on one particular example, that of Indonesia and the island of Kalimantan, particularly the province of Central Kalimantan, to illustrate the role that I think RED Plus Finance, particularly private sector engagement in RED Plus Finance, has to play. I think many are aware of the letter of intent between Norway and Indonesia that provides for financing of up to $1 billion for RED in Indonesia. And we know that this is just the tip of the iceberg of what is actually needed in order to transform the way forests are used and managed in Indonesia. Let me go back and give you two examples to illustrate what I mean. In his opening presentation, Andrew pointed a useful term of eco-utilities, that forests are eco-utilities and they provide a service. Let me illustrate this in the context, it's a surprising context of transport of coal in central Kalimantan, in Kalimantan, which is Indonesian Borneo as a whole. Now, an assessment of transport costs of coal in the province suggests that it costs roughly six times as much to transport coal by road as it does by barge. And if you were to build a railway, and there's a proposal right now to build a railway, that would be about 10% more expensive than simply barging the coal down the rivers. The problem here, though, is that the rivers are starting, many of the rivers are starting to run dry during the dry season because forests are being cleared upstream. So what happens is your ebb and flow of the river is those peaks and troughs are more accentuated because there's no modulating influence of forests. This in itself is a huge concern for the government of Indonesia, who are seeing an expansion of coal mining as one of the revenue sources. So here you have a link between forests and another sector, and RED Plus as an instrument that could create synergies between mine output and the costs and returns from that output. So that's just one example. The big one, of course, the one that everybody talks about is palm oil in the context of deforestation, one of the primary drivers of deforestation in Kalimantan. Here, too, the government is working very hard to look at both the issue of investment in productivity of the oil palm industry. Currently, estimates are between 70% and 90% of all profits come from the initial plantation stage, not from refinement, so no value addition along the chain. If the value addition has been captured along the chain, there will be less incentive to expand. And the second part of it is, and this had Indonesian legislation to put a moratorium on the expansion of palm oil, was to try and create incentives for the private sector to invest in degraded lands rather than in forested lands, because there's over 1 million hectares of degraded land which could benefit from the expansion of palm oil, which is a legitimate use of land, rather than expanding into forest areas, which, as Andrew has pointed out, provide a lot more services than carbon. All of this is, on the concern of the government of Indonesia, and they are currently weighing up options. So it is critically important, the yang, if you like, to the yin of the global negotiations, that countries themselves step up, understand Red Plus as an opportunity for development, an opportunity to transform to a green economy, because only a transformation to a green economy is going to assure the values of Red Plus. And that transformation will not take place, for all the reasons that this excellent report highlights, without private sector investment. So I'd just like to end there.
Ravi, thank you very much to you and to all the speakers for their comments. We've now got an extended by 15 minutes, so we've got 20 minutes for Q&A left. So if any of you listening have further questions, please do jump on the Q&A, the function to send the chat function, send in your questions in written form, and we'll do our best to go through them. I have just one little anecdote which I've been thinking about listening to all this. Over the weekend, I was in the very beautiful city of Sevilla in Spain. And this city is a long way from the coast, up a river. Rather, your remarks made me think of this. And it became famous in the 16th century, after Columbus discovered Latin America, who came, and he's buried there in Seville. And the city grew rich on vast amounts of gold plundered by Spanish galleons from South America. And as the population of Seville grew and their cities looked beautiful, their population expanded and they had to cut down more and more of their forests to grow food for agriculture to grow food. And then something happened which destroyed the city. The river silted up and the gold galleons could not get up the river anymore, bringing their plunder. And so the power of Seville declined, and it went to the coast to Cadiz. Well, there's a lesson there, perhaps, in what we're discussing now, about the combination between the need for agriculture and the need to protect forests. And this is going to become acute in the world as we seek to feed 9 billion people in the coming decades. Red may be a solution to rebalance and reset this. That's why it's called Ready, Set, Grow, perhaps. So I'd like to jump into some of the questions now that people have been asking. And related to that, I wanted to get into a political question that a number of people have asked, which is why, when the private sector is responsible for destroying these forests, in many cases, by converting them for agriculture, why are so many countries against the private sector coming in with a solution through RED? In other words, they would prefer to use government money rather than private sector money. And I'm going to ask Ravi to comment on that, because I think with UN RED you must see a lot of this coming through from different countries. Could you comment on the differing views about private sector engagement in RED in developing countries?
Right. My sense is although there is a fair amount of trepidation at the moment about how the market might function, I think that is quite different from the attitude to private sector investment. The market, and we know from the Munden Project Report that there are still concerns about how that will be structured, etc., which I don't want to go into at the moment. But on the other hand, private sector investment is certainly being welcomed. Countries themselves, and I'm speaking here from my experience from developing countries, know that they do not have the resources on their own to make the shifts that are necessary. In addition, that unless they can get private sector engagement in this, there is no long-term sustainability possible. So in almost all the countries that we're working in where there is a sufficiently sophisticated understanding of REDD+, there are really active efforts to engage the private sector in the development of forests, the development of agriculture, the development of energy as it impacts on forests and REDD+. So this is true of Indonesia, it's true of the Democratic Republic of Congo, it is true nascent thinking in Nigeria, it is true of to lesser extent in sort of more planned economies such as Vietnam, but even there there is an interest in private sector engagement. However, creating the context to de-risk private sector investment, there I think a lot of work still needs to take place in countries. This is recognized in many places. The Indonesians talk about de-bottlenecking their policy and legal frameworks so as to allow investments to flow.
There are a couple of other concerns that have been raised by Emily and others about the idea of offsetting with credits, carbon credits, and that in fact, there's this balance between who pays. Is it going to be governments or could it be the private sector? And if it is the private sector, are they really paying or are forest credits just in a sense letting them off, reducing their emissions so that they're offsetting emissions by buying forest credits? Stephen, do you want to comment on that issue, perhaps from a UK government perspective?
Thanks, Andrew. In terms of offsets and is it just shifting the burden? I mean, offsets, I think, have been shown to be a legitimate way of trying to achieve a long-term emissions reduction at minimum cost, and that's why the flexibility for offsets was included in the Kyoto Protocol. In terms of whether REDD offsets are going to be the future, I think they may be part of the future, but they certainly won't be the whole future. I think the amount of there will be issues probably with demand versus supply in terms of how much developed countries could try and offset, and clearly if you want to get to a low carbon economy, then you can't just offset the whole way. So I think carbon credits will probably be part of the future, but I think, what you showed, Andrew, in your initial slide, trying to value ecosystem services more broadly is going to be important.
Yeah, thank you. Let's hear from the private sector. Abid, what's your view on this, that some of these, developing country governments are very concerned that offsetting into their forests is going to be not good for them? How can you convince them that it will be?
Well, I think there's a couple of important points there. One is it's possible for the REDD+ segment of an eventual carbon market to introduce minimum performance standards so that we are able to ensure that for every ton of CO2 delivered through a REDD+ credit, you actually do begin to see all of the other benefits that the various speakers have spoken about. It's not just about carbon, it's about a whole range of biodiversity and ecosystem services. And there are ways of embedding that in the market through performance standards. That's one. The second would be, to keep in mind that offsets are part of a broader market approach. It's not that offsets exist by themselves. They exist in conjunction with emission reduction targets. And the tougher targets that are imposed, the more flexibility you have in increasing the share of offsets. And I think it's about getting that balance right, as Steve said. And ultimately, that's a matter for the political class to address.
One of the things that's clear is that government funding alone is very unlikely to be able to solve this problem of paying for reducing deforestation. And this is something we can get on with now. Unlike, it takes 30 years to build a nuclear power station, we might be able to halve deforestation within a decade or more. So it's worth doing it now, not later. But to do that, we may need some help from the private sector. In fact, we certainly will. But one of the big risks the private sector says they have is regulatory risk. That is that if they do put their money in there, then some national government might change the rules or run off with their investment. And that's a great concern to them. So what are governments doing about dealing with that regulatory risk? I'm not sure really whether this is one for Stephen or Ravi, because Stephen is the only national government, in a sense, on the panel, but not one that owns a lot of tropical forests. So it may be hard for you, Stephen, to answer that question. Do you want to comment just on the question of regulatory risk? And maybe, Ravi, you could come in with a quick comment after that, from a government perspective.
I guess from the government perspective, in terms of regulatory risk, I think we are aware that from both, I guess, the private sector and the public sector putting money into some developing countries, there is risks around regulatory risk. And I think, the idea that RED has phases, and the first sort of phases are involve things such as improving governance structures and that sort of thing. I think that is how we can try and address or reduce the investment risk to I guess donor countries and to the private sector.
Ravi, do you have a quick comment on that?
All I can say is sort of paraphrase what I said earlier, that I don't think that governments have the answers yet, but I do know that there's a lot of work taking place, particularly with sort of within the UN RED program, looking at all these risks and trying to safeguard both the RED opportunities that forests provide, but also looking at the entire governance structure, from sort of supporting governments on monitoring through to dealing with transparency and corruption risks. It's a slow process because we're talking about system change, a real transformation. So not too much to add to what Stephen just said.
Mark has asked a question about standards and accounting. If credits are to be sold, then we need to know they're real and that the quality of these credits is good. I'm not sure, maybe Christian, could you comment a bit on this question, that how do you feel from a private sector that you could be certain the credits you're going to buy are going to be real?
Thank you, Andrew. Absolutely. I mean, as an active investor into the space, one of the questions that emerges when we're considering screening investments and doing our due diligence is, are they actually going to generate assets which we can monetize? Because this, BNP Paribas is in this on a for-profit model. It's not a CSR donor-based model. So you're absolutely right. We need to have a degree of confidence that the rigor is there, both from the carbon accounting side and also, just as importantly, from the side of social and environmental local credibility. We have put a lot of effort into understanding and I think helping to shape, certainly via our partners, the outcomes at VCS and CCB. We place a high degree of confidence in both of those standard bodies to deliver in their respective spheres. And not only do we have a degree of confidence in them, we do believe that they are taking decisive steps to improve even now. As it stands, CCB, particularly when you apply gold, is as far as I'm concerned, the highest mark that you can really achieve, certainly recognizable mark that you can achieve on the social and biodiversity side. And the key is, as I tried to mention, it might have been after I was asked to hurry up, so I might have just skipped over it, but the key is to for those conversations that are happening between actors in the VCS and CCB world and the people providing the IP on developing those methodologies are brought into the conversation with SUBSTA as soon as possible, because there's a lot of technical competency and proficiency sitting out there that has learned whilst doing it. And there's no point when we have the urgency that you've mentioned, Andrew, for us to reinvent the wheel. I think we need to dovetail the expertise that exists in VCS and CCB with the modality development at the UN level, and that goes for safeguards as well.
A number of people have talked about inconsistencies here. Hannah talks about the inconsistency between trying to reduce our use of coal and yet then advocating transporting coal by river because we release less emissions that way. Than cutting forests and so on. Others on degraded land and land grabs that are beginning to occur, particularly in Africa. And now let's just think that if we're just stop deforestation, a lot of the solution lies outside the forest, not in it. It lies in the farmlands around those forests. And yes, we should move on to degraded land and increase efficiency, stop deforestation at the frontiers. But won't that just lead to a sort of private sector land grab? And anyway, what is degraded land? How do you define it? And this has been very important, for instance, in the conversion of forests to palm oil. So, Abid, could I ask you to comment on these questions of what we are seeing out there, which are big land grabs going on, and if we are to deal with degraded land, how can that operate in a safeguarded way?
So I think, you know, this is a very critical issue, and, you know, it's actually one where there's a good deal of alignment between what the private sector is looking for and views of civil society, because, you know, if you are to go down a road where you have a market-based instrument, you know, carbon markets or otherwise, you know, one thing that markets need to be successful is clear legal title, and you know, we see that theme coming up, you know, over and over again in some of the pilot projects, which, you know, several financial institutions and others are involved with. If you're going to be looking to create, to assign some value to an asset, you absolutely have to be sure that that asset has clear legal title. And so in the case of forestry and agroforestry, it becomes all the more important. And so I would look at this not from a land grab perspective, but from a shared incentive for all parties to make sure that there is clear legal title in any of the assets which are being developed or eventually traded.
We only have a few more minutes now, and I want to ask another question which is key, which has been raised by a few people, and that is demand. How can we stimulate demand for the private, which will attract the private sector in? It seems to me that without a carbon market, with the compliance market still being a year or two away, probably even a decade away, what do we do now? And one of the ideas would be to create advanced market demands by having government money used to buy forest credits at a floor price and perhaps create something like the World Bank's Biocarbon Fund. So what would the thoughts be of government money being used to help stimulate market demand through an advanced market demand mechanism? And I'm going to ask Stephen, if you're still there, to answer that question, because our own government is likely to have quite a lot of money to spend on RED in the coming years. Could you talk a bit about that, and then we might have someone from the private sector to respond. Over to you, Stephen. Are you there?
Yes, Andrew, thanks. Yeah, I think that's an important question because, I mean, at the moment we have, you know, of the order of 5 billion-ish pounds, 5 billion-ish dollars in RED, and we know we need a lot more sort of the 20s, the 30s by 2020. So stimulating now. So I mentioned in my talk that, you know, catalyzing the private sector was one of the things that we wanted to do. And there are, you know, policy is under development at the moment, but one of the ideas is a fund such as what you have described. So, you know, a public fund geared to support private sector investment. You know, it's an interesting idea, and as I say, it's an idea that's undergoing investigation at the moment. I guess, you know, from the public sector point of view, you'd have to, you know, trying to balance the value for money for the taxpayer, trying to ensure that you catalyse the private sector to the right level. So that probably implies buying down some of the risk that the private sector sees, but you know, I guess we couldn't underwrite the whole lot of risk, and I don't think the private sector would expect us to underwrite the whole lot of risk.
Thank you for that, Stephen. Could we have one quick comment from the private sector, Christian, because we have to wrap up, perhaps 30 seconds on would that sort of fund help you get your investments moving?
Absolutely, and we've been involved in discussions to help conceptualize how that might look. I mean, I think looking at it from the standpoint of the public sector for just a second is quite obvious. It's clear from the private sector standpoint, understanding what your worst case scenario is when you're developing assets that don't have a clear path to valuation over the sort of the investment horizon, that's clearly a problem. It's one of the biggest, if not the biggest, barrier right now for us. But looking at it from the public sector's point of view, if there is a finite amount of capital deployed into such a fund, and then as long as emission reductions are achieved, which are exhibiting the necessary criteria for safeguards and rigor of carbon accounting, that fund can be drawn upon to monetize those emission reductions in the event that there's no other alternative available, really delivers something important to treasuries of donor countries, because you don't take any risk at the end of the day. You're only paying for performance that meets with your acceptance, and the taxpayer is not sending money to a country far away, perhaps that he's never heard of, and just hoping that those emission reductions arise at some point in time and contribute to our efforts to mitigate climate change. So I think it puts the risk on the actors most able to deal with it, and keeping the pricing risk, or at least the underwriting of it, on the side of the public sector, because after all, the policy risk is inextricably linked to market risk when it comes to RED right now.
Well, thank you very much. I'm afraid we're out of time. We're going to have to wrap up now. And I wanted to thank all the speakers for their interesting remarks and to thank all those who have participated in this event. You will get a chance 6 hours from now at 4 o'clock British Standard Time. British summer time to at 4 o'clock, that is today, and 6 hours from now, there is another webinar, a repeat of this, so perhaps some of you didn't get their questions answered could pose them again then. I wanted to remind you that you can download the report, the UNEP Finance Initiative report, from their website. So if you Google UNEP FI, you'll be able to find the ReadySet Grow Part 2. And also there'll be an important meeting coming up on the week of the 19th of October, which is the tipping point, the Global Roundtable 2011, from the 19th to the 20th of October in Washington, D.C., when, as you can see on the screen, a number of key speakers will be speaking. And lastly, I just wanted to end by thanking UNEP-FI for giving us all this initiative to learn more about Ready, Set, Grow. Thank you very much, and see you in 6 hours.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining today's webinar. You may now replace your handset.